Go. All right. Well, hello, everyone. It's 3 o'clock, so I think I'm going to get going. I guess that seems loud enough, doesn't it? Okay. If you're looking for discussion-based teaching, I'm Jeff Saws. You're in the right place. I have one thing I want to say before I got going. Between when I made the outline, this is one of the things that frustrates me, between when I made the outline and now, I've probably deviated from that flight plan a little bit. So one of the things I've noticed between last year and this year is that someone will be talking and the audience will be sort of flipping back and forth trying to figure out where we are. I tried to keep it close to it, but I think I kind of hit on these things at different points. So I apologize for that, but I just want to make you aware of that. I don't want you all to get frustrated because all of a sudden it doesn't seem quite the same. Anyway, so there you go. I am coming in to my third year at Regents, and I teach 11th and 12th grade history, and those are both discussion-based classes, meaning pretty much 100% of the time I teach class through a class discussion of some kind or another. So that was one of the things that drew me to Regents, was the fact that I firmly believe that discussion is the best way to get the kids involved in learning. As much as I'm standing here lecturing today, which is sort of awkward, I'll only do that for a little bit. To get the kids, I love history. I'm a history teacher. I love lit. I don't always get to teach it, but all the kids don't necessarily love history or love lit. My goal is to try to get them to love the learning process, and in that, whether they love history or not, grow to know it so well that they appreciate it. And so that's sort of my kind of philosophy, and one of the things that drew me to Regents was the fact that they do this discussion-based teaching, and I love it, and I think the kids get a lot out of it, and that's why I am excited to talk to you guys today. My class generally operates where the kids, first thing I always do is have about 10 to 15 minutes of writing. So these are kind of the key components of my class: writing, all right, the kids talking, and then a lot of my classes tend to be punctuated by me telling strange stories. I love all sorts of things, including history. I love science. I love engineering and a wide array of strange things. I like carpentry and stuff. So very often when we're talking about different parts of history, I'll say, oh, I have a story. I want to tell you guys a story. And it'll be about architecture, about how carpenters in 750 built something because I was reading a text. So my class tends to operate in that way. They write for a while on a prompt, discuss a little bit. I like to tell stories. That's sort of the general gist of the class. Our class sizes are nice. We have 16 to 18 kids in a class, and that makes it very manageable. That's not the case everywhere. Before I taught at Regents, I taught at a high school also here in Austin, and I had 25 kids in a class. And those were lecture-based classes, and having a discussion was tough. I had different strategies to handle that, and hopefully we'll get to talk about those a little bit today. The structure of our classroom for humanities, for all grades 9 through 12, and our hope is to get this through in the future 7 through 12, is that I have a giant table. We call it a Harkness table in the middle of the room. It's about 8 foot by 16 foot mesquite oval table. And all my students sit around the table. I sit on top of my desk and sort of preside over the class as they're discussing. But the class itself is structured in such a way that all the kids are facing each other. In a lecture room like this, you can sit in the way back and kind of hide from me. But in a discussion room, it's set up so that all the kids are facing each other. And they're not necessarily facing me. And there's a reason for that. It's because I want the conversation to be between them and not necessarily them trying to find the right answer to show me. So I have them all face each other. They're at this table. We call them Harkness tables, and if I do that, it's because there was a man named Harkness who donated a series of tables to Exeter Academy in New Hampshire, and this is the model we kind of use. So it's a little different. If you're interested in learning more, you can look at Phillips Exeter Academy in New Hampshire online, and there's a whole history of the Harkness, why they have their tables. We do a little bit differently at Regents, but his whole philosophy was that to learn, he came up, he saw these tables and said, this would be the best way to teach. And to learn, that you talk things out, you have discussions with each other, you're face-to-face, you're looking in each other's eye, you're using their names. He thought that was the best way. So he got the ball rolling there at Exeter, and we kind of adopted that at Regents. And that's kind of the background of why we have these tables and why we do discussion at Regents. It breaks down a little bit differently per grade. Okay, I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about my classes, but here's the caveat to that. In 11th and 12th grade, I discuss exclusively, primarily because 7 through 10 does a good job of getting them ready for discussion. So if we work backwards, in history and in lit, in 11th and 12th grade, they're almost primarily discussion-based classes. 10th grade literature is maybe a 50-50 discussion and lecture class. And history in 10th grade is probably more like a 30-70 blend, 30% discussion, 70% lecture. And in 10th grade, a lot of the kids are still learning how to be historians. They're still learning how to discern what are good facts to know long term, what are good facts to use as evidence, and that's primarily why 10th grade still has a lot of lecture. 9th grade is an important year because for us it's a transition, really for anyone, from the school of logic to the school of rhetoric. So the kids go through a lot of different pressures between 8th grade and 9th grade. And so 9th grade is really the year at Regents where the kids start to learn what it's like to sit at these tables, what it's like to have history and lit at these tables, and start discussing. So in freshman level, there's a lot more lecture in history and a lot more in lit also. Because they're learning how to be high school students, they're learning how to discuss, they're learning really the ropes of a new school, even though they're just a few feet down in the campus, it's a new school. So and that would apply to any high school where kids are coming from all over, is that it's new to them, so the experience is different. 7th and 8th grade for us, the school of logic, is more Socratic in nature. They do have discussions, but at that age level, the kids are still kind of learning how to be good students. They're learning how to come up with rational arguments, and they're still in that developmental stage. So their discussions don't necessarily mirror what we do in the high school, but they have discussions nonetheless. And so there's a progression from 7 up of increasing discussion. And for us, it's the culmination of their ability to discuss, present, defend their argument is their senior thesis, which they give at the end of their senior year. And it's a 20-minute presentation, generally memorized, and followed up by 20 minutes of panel questioning. So there'll be teachers, parents, experts on a panel questioning the student about their thesis. So a lot of what we do in terms of development through the classroom is based upon getting the kids ready to be able to speak well, defend what they're saying, and do it coherently. So the discussion environment is very good for that. Now, on to kind of my planning a little bit. When it comes to the actual me conducting the class, here's what it looks like. My planning for any particular week or unit or class actually comes way ahead of the class itself. With a discussion environment, you need to be able to know as the teacher watching this, if you're going to do it, where the discussion could go. It's kind of like being a great chess player. They don't just know 2 moves ahead. They know 20 potential moves ahead or 100. Or they actually can see the whole game take place till their victory. In a discussion environment, to avoid being relative and having the kids define history, define lit, define math and science, it can be done anywhere, on their own terms. You have to know where it could go. And you need to be able to steer it or head it off or stop it if they're going down the wrong road. But what that means is prep happens slightly differently than for a lecture. For a lecture, you know, I study my notes, make sure I got it, and boom, try to knock them dead. For discussion, I have to read. There's a lot of reading involved. In the reading, I create discussion questions and come up with questions, bring those to class, and usually right before class starts, I figure out which one I actually want to start the day with and throw that on the board. But those questions match where I want the kids to eventually be a month down the road. So So my prep is, you start looking at the year. It's much easier, I would say, for experienced teachers, because you kind of have already seen what the year looks like, so you kind of know, oh, okay, if we could talk about this here in October, it would set me up great for November. Okay. So experience helps a little bit, but the work for us is on the front end as teachers. It's getting ahead of the kids, knowing where they could possibly go, being able to correct when they kind of step off the path a little bit. We meet 4 days a week. I don't know how many times you all meet a week, but we meet 4 days a week. My first meeting of the week, the kids, their homework for that first meeting will be to read the chapter in the book. So whatever their textbook is, if it's European history, which is my 11th grade class, it'll be a section from Palmer and Colton's History of the Modern World, or maybe two. For my United States history, it's a section from their U.S. history textbook. And so they have to read that for the first meeting of the week. And so that first meeting really shapes up where we're setting up a discussion, but the discussion will be around, often I'll put, say this were my board, I'd have key terms up here. And so the discussion may focus on the key terms, what those key terms are. It's really setting up a foundation for the week on that first meeting. I usually then assign, my homework assignment is a primary source reading for that second day. So at the 11th grade level, I will assign a primary source reading, and the kids will take it home, read it, study it, take notes, do whatever they have to do. They'll come into class, and I'll write a prompt for their discussion, and they start with my prompt. Seniors, they'll go home, read the passage. They have to write prompts, and they'll turn the prompts into me. I pick the best one, and I put that prompt on the board, and their 10 minutes of writing begins when I write the prompt on the board. So if you actually came into one of my senior classes, really what you'd see is the kid writing a prompt, the kids discussing, and me taking notes. And you'd probably think, what is this guy getting paid to do? That's a sweet deal. Because I'm sitting on my desk while they're talking. But the reality is the finding those readings that actually make sense and are intelligible to the kids is not always easy. Or at least I don't have an easy job with that. I have a hard time with that. Very often I'll give a reading and the kids' eyes are kind of, I didn't get that at all, you know. And so part of the learning process of me going through this with the kids is finding readings that challenge the kids, but not so much that they don't get it. And I know our 10th grade and 9th grade teachers do similar pattern where they'll do primary source readings, they'll discuss those. In literature, they'll discuss the text, or even they'll discuss the history going on at the time the text was written. So there's a lot of overlap between the two. I know math and science do discussion also. When they get to a point in time where they're talking about a particular mathematician or scientist, they'll have discussions about the history going on at that time, what was going on. And so a lot of the discussion allows teachers of any discipline to frame what you're trying to teach in the history or in the context or make it relevant to the kids through discussion. The reason I like this so much is that the lecture method really left the kids dependent upon me to learn. So if I had a good day and I felt like I knocked it out, they had a good class. If I didn't, they sort of got a lousy day. And the reading they had to do then was really just to get a foundation for hearing me say kind of the same thing. And I could still tell the stories, and it still made things a little more kind of spicy and fun. But the reality was they got what they got out of the reading. They kind of got what they got out of me talking, but that was sort of mediocre. So in those two middle days of discussion of primary texts, they're really getting into the history, or they're really getting into literature, or whatever they're doing. And then the last meeting of the week, that fourth meeting, so two and three look the same. The fourth meeting, I have them write usually for 20 or 30 minutes. So I'll generate a prompt that has a little more scope and depth. An example might be, I love to use AP. One of the things that's great about AP prompts for their longer writing assignments is that they do a very good job of covering, say, in history, a 40-year time period. And you can use them very well to get the kids to think not only about what we're talking about has relevance to the time period we're specifically talking about, but it also came out of a certain time and it's going to lead to the future. And so my questions usually involve getting the kids to tie what we're talking about into either the past or into predicting the future. One of my joke questions I often ask the kids is, given what you know about the past, predict the future. There's only one correct answer. You'll be graded on whether or not I agree with you. And they kind of, it's tough on, they joke about that, and I wouldn't ever really give it. But that's kind of what we're doing, though, is we're looking at the trend, what's going on, and we're talking about where things are going. And that gives the kids a framework. One thing I will say before I get in on a separate part here is discussion is great and discussion is fun, but it's not the reason for having a discussion-based class. And that's really key. I can get teenagers talking for an hour about anything, and it's not valuable. So discussion is not the goal. Discussion is the tool to get the kids into the history or the lit or the math or science. So that's why the development that goes on in 7th and 8th grade and 9th and 10th grade is so crucial, because what they're doing is they're developing the kids' tool of discussion so that they're ready for 11th and 12th grades, where that's all they're using, really. So one of the areas, just to hit something off, one of the areas where a lot of people who are trying this out for the first time, myself included when I first started with this, was discussion is, well, what do you guys think? What does this look like to you? And teenagers are great at telling you what they think, and they're great at telling you what they believe, but what they're thinking and what they believe isn't necessarily grounded in the same things we're thinking. So there's an easy danger of becoming too relative. And one of the common questions I get is, well, how do you avoid, in a discussion environment with teenagers, how do you keep the class from being relativistic? And the kids just defining terms based on what they feel and believe, and that's a great question. And the trick to that is getting ahead of the kids. You keep it from being relativistic by saying, well, that's an interesting point, but here's where your analysis of this is a little off. Your analysis seems to be based on this particular point, whereas what's really going on is here. And kindly steer them in the right direction. You have to nip that type of stuff in the bud, but you can't crush someone's spirit at the same time. Like, I come and say, no, that's wrong. How could you say that's way off? And what I've just done is I've told that kid to shut up for life. And I've told the rest of the class what I'm really looking for is the right answer. And so my class will shift gradually from discussion to the kids kind of, is this the right answer? And they'll kind of say something, but it'll be with fear because they don't want me to crush them. And they'll hope it's what I was looking for. And that's no longer discussion. That's really kind of a lecture with commentary. And so part of having a discussion environment is being very firm about there is truth. You have to be going in the right direction here. But you preserve the student's dignity in not crushing them when they say something that's incorrect. But you have to get it correct before you can move on. Otherwise, your discussion is based upon false truth. You can't have that. So this is one of those little things that as you start thinking about, oh, I want to try this in some of my classes, how do I prepare? You got to look way ahead. I'll get more into that in a minute. I always think of The View. Right? Conversation isn't great. I happened to stumble across The View by accident, and they were all yelling at each other, and I couldn't understand anything. They were having a conversation in their mind, but it had no value. And I was thinking, at the end of this hour or whatever length of this show, what will be their greater knowledge, or what will be my greater knowledge? And in the 30 seconds I saw, I wasn't sure there was one, because they were just yammering about what they thought. So it was too relative to whatever the contemporary issue was at the time. So in a discussion environment, we need to keep it grounded in whether it be history lit, but in truth. And don't be afraid to say, you know, I see where you're going, but here's kind of a different perspective, and here's really the right way. To do that, though, you need to know what the right way is. You need to get out there. If you're studying 1812, and the kids start talking about the significance of the War of 1812, you can't just say, well, the treaty ended up with kind of a neutral thing. You have to know, okay, well, this had an influence on foreign policy, and it shaped lots of things down the road. And when you give the kids that context, they have kind of an aha moment, which is good. All right. Now, enough of that for now. I want to give you guys a little example. In sitting on my desk, I take notes. I write down everything everybody says. If it's something that I think is ludicrous or they're goofing around and talking to a friend, I'll write in the top of my notebook, Steve is talking to Ann. And what that serves as a reminder for me that when I'm thinking participation grade, they were talking. And, or, you know, so-and-so is sleeping. Usually I correct that pretty quickly. It doesn't usually happen. But you get the point that if there's a behavioral issue, because we still have to monitor classroom discipline, if there's a behavioral issue, I write it down in the side or on the top or wherever I'm going to see it when I go through my notes. So every class has a notebook. Every day has the prompt, and I get going with my notes. It usually has a date and then my prompt and then the responses from the kids. When I write down what a student says, so I might put, you know, Rachel. I'll write down what she says, and I kind of write a letter grade right there that I would think would be appropriate for that. General, A, B, C, something like that. I don't usually fail a kid for saying something that I don't think is correct, because the environment I'm trying to create is one where people will speak, and I will train them how to speak well and say what is correct. So even a kid who doesn't say anything at all, I will rarely give below a failing grade, just because they're also not distracting from the class. We've all had distractors. And so if a kid isn't speaking, I'll notice it because I have notes from class. I'll say, you know, for the last 3 days, you didn't say anything. Oh, I know. Usually they say, I know. I didn't think what I had to say was smart. At that point, I'll say, all right, well, do tonight's reading. Come into my class with a question. Show me the question before class. And then you be the first one to speak in class when the prompt is over. But what if my question isn't your prompt? I don't care. Ask the question. See what your classmates have to say in an answer. Okay, and it just gives them the confidence to start speaking. So I take notes. And what I did is I looked at the first class of last year's seniors of the year, where we actually did a discussion. So it would be the second day. Our first day, I usually go over the rules of the class and what they should expect, and that A's will be hard to get and all that good stuff. And so what I did is I wrote down the first 18 comments. And the 18th is me. All right. So the 17 comments are from the kids on my question. The summer reading for the seniors is a book by Victor Davis Hanson, who's a classical historian. The book's called Carnage and Culture. It's kind of long. Not all the kids loved it, but it has good stuff in it. So the first day back, we started discussing. I asked a simple question. What was Hanson's thesis? Simple question. I'm glad I didn't have to answer it. But I want you to pay attention to a couple things. Listen to the first, it's six responses. Okay, think about, what do these actually contain? All right, are these what I would consider good responses? Think a bit about when you as a teacher, if this were your class, when would you want to jump in and say something with what the kids are saying? Now, I know you haven't read the book and all, but just think about, are they using fact to support what they're saying? Is what they're saying opinion? Where are they going with this? And then also, as I will go, you'll notice the length and the quality of responses changes. Okay, so, and then I'll explain why I cut it off when I did. Okay, so my question was, what was Hanson's thesis? First response. This is from a person who the year before never really spoke, got a C- for participation, lowered her grade a lot because participation is 30%. Of the overall grade in my class. And so she, at the beginning of the year, said, what can I do? I said, be the first to speak. Boom, she was. What's his thesis? One, Western military was superior because of group discipline. Okay. Two, another person who never speaks, freedom was all she said. She got it out there. Three, Western culture spread because they were more effective killers and fought for personal freedom. Four, yes, there's a response to the statement before. Yes, but why did they have this more personal reason for fighting? Five, different person. Well, because they were fighting for their sense of country, land, and self. Six, since they were more individualistic, they had the ability to self-critique. Okay, now here's where I'll stop. Were they specific? Did the students, the chapter, the book's broken into nine segments about nine different cultures. Which culture are they talking about? I have no idea. Are they being specific at all? No. Would you guys have stepped in, do you think, and said, be specific? Would this have irritated you that they're just talking generally about what's going on? Probably would have. 4 years ago, I would have gone crazy. Seventh statement. Like at Salamis, where freedom was defined by their ability to improvise on the battlefield and take action and initiative. Ah, we're getting some substance here. Eight, the concept of capitalism was also important because it often allowed Western armies to be better equipped. Didn't follow along, but they're trying to get their thing out. Nine, well, there's no single one thing. Hansen is arguing that weapons were not the only decisive factor. So finally, nine statements in, someone is addressing the question, which is, what is this guy talking about? Okay, so the first six statements, which are general, are what I kind of call the shotgun start. Okay, a lot of the kids are anxious, they're nervous. This happens to be the first day of the year, so they're not quite sure what I'm going to do. But every day is kind of like this. They throw out everything they remember that was a buzzword from the text they had to read the night before. They just get it out there. But what those are, they're seeds for other people thinking about what they're going to say. So I don't cut that off unless it's wrong because they're not getting specific. I'll let one of the students get more specific. Okay. 10. One of the biggest differences between the Spanish and the Aztecs was not the weapons, but the purpose of fighting. The Spanish armies killed their enemies. The Aztec armies captured them. Therefore, the objectives in battle, driven by culture, dictate different styles of fighting and therefore success. Ah, that's pretty much where I wanted to go. All right, so now we get to see where else the class is going. Question from a kid. So how then does the chapter about Vietnam fit in here? Because that was a very different chapter. What made Vietnam so different? So that was a great question. Response, it was widely publicized where other battles had not been. So now on to 13. The concept of progress was available for audit by the public. Audit is a term that Hansen used when he was talking about Greek armies and how soldiers could audit their leaders. 14. The media had a tremendous influence on the fighting of the war. Usually when media comes up, I start to think, this could be interesting. We'll see where this goes. So that's kind of a buzzword for me. 15. The purpose was questioned by the non-fighting public, where in the other examples, there was no option for citizens in general to question the operations of the war. So they thought, wow, that's a great statement. 16. Not true. One of his points about Greek citizen soldiers is that they would have the ability as citizen soldiers to critique the decisions made. And then now we're going back and forth between two people. Yes, but the soldiers would audit. And so what I saw then is an argument between two people that was alienating the class. So I stopped and said, okay. But tagging on to the idea of what they were talking about, they were getting this idea, which was great. There's a difference in, Hansen is arguing, between citizen soldiers and citizens who aren't at war. So I just asked the question, okay, how do conscription, armies based upon conscription and armies based upon voluntary enlistment differ? How would Hansen address this? So I brought him back to the book, but kept with the same idea. And then, so that would be the end, and then they kept on discussing. That took, though, about 10 minutes of them thinking about the question, and then another maybe 15 or 20 minutes of discussion. So that was only 18 points, but it takes about 25, 30 minutes. That seems odd. One of the things I have to become very comfortable with silence. And being a teacher, I don't like silence. And you can read pretty quickly when you ask a question and everybody looks at you. They're not thinking about the question. They're trying to figure out what on earth question I just asked. So you can judge your own questions by, if you ask a question, they all kind of have this dazed look like, what on earth are you talking about? The silence that follows is them thinking, I don't know what to say. If you ask a question, they all look down, start taking notes, maybe flip through their book. The silence that follows is okay because what they're doing is thinking. So one of the things that in a discussion environment that the students have to get used to this also, as I say at the beginning of class, I assume silence is thinking. That's what I assume. I'm always trying to figure out what it is for sure. But I assume silence is thinking. That way, they feel comfortable thinking. I don't want them, when I ask a question, because they haven't really thought out my question or the other student's question. They're just trying to say what they really want. They want to do that shotgun deal where they just get their thing out, and that's still not quite a discussion. Okay, so silence in a lot of times is them working their way up to building a discussion and thinking, how am I going to answer the question, but also respond to what this person just said, because now what I was going to say doesn't fit. And so a lot of times you might have a kid who sits for 40 minutes of the 50-minute class and then finally, with 5 minutes to go, knocks the whole class dead with this great statement. Because the whole time they've been listening and listening and figuring it out, and they may make one comment, which is an A-plus comment, but other people may make 15 comments, and they're okay, and some of them are really good, and some of them aren't. So that's why I say when I take my notes, I'd be very careful about rating that the quality of comment, because one doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. One could be the comment that gets the whole class to understand what's going on. So that's kind of what my class looks like. My question then for you guys is, I have about 20 different questions that are always asked of me in case you have none. But my reason for being here is to help you and answer your questions. So first, I'm going to tell you what that is. Okay. I not only take notes, which is great for me. Sometimes, I didn't do this almost at all last year, but I know my colleagues do. Sometimes what I'll do is I'll pull a student out of the discussion. And this is great if you have more than fit in a logical space. So if you can circle up 15 desks really nicely, but you still have three kids out in the fringe, you give those three kids a task. Okay, one might be overall note taker. One might be summarizer. As they listen to the conversation, they're summarizing the main points. And one I often do, they like to be called the webmaster. Okay, so what that is a drawing of my table. All right, and I've made up names of a couple of several students who would be sitting around. So I would have a table, and I would have a drawing, and I'd have everybody's name. And usually I have me. And what I'll do is, this is my question. That's the prompt. Okay? And then what you do is I have the kids track the discussion. So in the case of what I just read to you, it might look something like this. You might have my prompt that Bill answers, but Callie tags off of Bill's response, Ben adds to Callie's response, and Sally throws in another question. So the kids then are watching. It's not me. I got my notes. The kids are watching. And from that removed place, they start to think, because they're teenagers, oh, how can I do this better too? Okay, so I've given them the task isn't just draw lines because I like doing that, but also to write what it is they're saying. So this might be a comment. All right, this is a question. And then Sally throws a question, JR answers the question, Steve tagged off it. And all of a sudden, Dave is starting to look mighty lonely here because Dave's not in the program. All right, and so what that also does is when it's Dave's turn to be the webmaster, Dave all of a sudden notices, well, gee, this person's not saying anything. And it just kind of makes the whole experience a little more real and practical for whoever's watching it. And the summarizer can summarize, and the note taker can take the notes. Everybody takes their own notes anyway, but if you have more than can fit or more than is reasonable to have in a group, that's one way of kind of coping or giving the kids a job where they're actually still learning the tools of discussion, but they're observers. I also have them track the use of this word. You won't be able to see it. Like. And I had one savvy kid say, you know, Rachel, you used like 14 times. Bill, you used it 3. Mr. Saz, you used it twice. Okay. And I mean like as a space filler. So on my wall, I have little red circles with lines through them of different phrases or words students are not allowed to use. Like is one of them. So I say, my room is a like-free environment. And if, unless you say, I like pork because it tastes like chicken, that's okay. Other than that, you can't use like. I believe is another one. because in history, anyway, I believe means you're no longer going to support what you're saying with fact. You're going to support it with personal opinion. And so the discussion is going to move away from being true to being relative because it's based on what you think. I think is another one. Okay, so last thing before you guys ask me your questions, the reason writing is so important in discussion is, one, kids are coming from math, science, Spanish test, I don't know, break up with a girlfriend in the hallway or whatever. They're coming into my class thinking about everything but my class. So it's 10 minutes of time they center on history or whatever your discipline is. All right. It's also time for them to reinforce what they're going to say, hopefully with good writing techniques. And writing and speaking, and they're reading good things, hopefully, they're writing well. Well, that means what they speak, what they say, mirrors what they write. And they don't write putting like in between words because they need space to think. They don't write and say, for hit my class, I believe that this is important because they get marked off huge on a paper. So I say, you don't use those when you're speaking in my class either. And we all do it. I throw it in every once in a while by accident anyway. But we're accountable to each other for that. And it gradually goes away. So I happen to notice in the senior thesis panel questioning sessions, not very many kids filled time with or like. And comes from the rhetoric teacher getting rid of in conversation. And the rest of the humanities getting rid of like as much as we can. So that being said, done with my thing. How many of you all have a class that's already based on discussion? And how many of you would like to try to do this maybe every once in a while, but not as an entire class? Cool. All right. Great. So what kind of questions do you guys have either about implementing it or things that I've messed up? That works too. Yes? Okay, during writing and discussion, are they allowed to use their text? Yes. It varies a little bit because sometimes that will cloud my ability to assess whether or not they've done the reading for homework. So for certain things, and it's really just based on my best judgment at the time, sometimes I will let them use the text, and under the prompt, I'll say, here's your prompt, you may use your text. Other times, I won't. If it's their homework, here's generally my rules. If it's their homework reading from the weekend, the textbook for the class, no. Because they had plenty of time to read that and get it. If it's a primary source reading that I've given them either in class or overnight, and what I'm trying to do is to have them in sort of good writing, use the primary source to support their argument, then yes. So I do balance it a little bit. If it's that Friday or that last day of the week, 30-minute writing, that's really an assessment, so no. So on tests and on quizzes, those 30-minute writing things, I don't let them use their book unless I give them a specific passage that they can use. I do. I collect that stuff every day. And so it's easy. I do get swamped sometimes. And so sometimes I'll say, I'm not collecting this, you know, the prompt is there. I'm not collecting the response. So you can do bullet points. You can do notes. Do whatever you need. Because the reality is I give the seniors 3 7- to 9-page papers and the juniors 2. And between that and tests and quizzes every week and all the writing, I'll get so far behind that I get in trouble, both with the kids, with the parents, and with my boss, which is bad. So, yes, ma'am? Oh, sorry, behind you. Sometimes, yes. The question was, do they get the prompt before the reading or after? I sort of cut you off by accident. Or after. For homework, they get the prompt after. For my in-class readings, I'll give them the prompt before, especially if it's a tougher text. Sometimes I have the juniors have sometimes a tough time because they're in European history. And so when we're reading about the Enlightenment and things like that, they get a little confused. So I'll sometimes give them the prompt knowing before they read, knowing that that's going to target how they read. That they're going to start reading, looking for an answer rather than reading, looking for total understanding. But that's okay. Yeah? Okay. Okay. Right. Yeah. Okay, so what grade do you have? Okay, so we have a seventh grade teacher with no textbook, no text. They don't have a text. So all the information, sorry, I'm clarifying for the people. Seventh grade teacher, the students don't have a text, the teacher does. And so the teacher's, your method of getting the information to the kids is really through lecture. Okay, so the question is, in that environment, how do we have a discussion? Can you get other readings that would be appropriate? Or is that your gross fact thing you were talking about? Right. Right. Okay. Last question. How much time do you have to cover in your class? No, I mean, like, what's the class? Is it, you know, European history from the fall of Rome till... Mm-hmm. Exploration. Okay, and you have the 1 year. Oh, that's good. Well, that's tough. That's a tough question to answer is really but a tough situation. One of the things that is, I'm going to sort of circuitously answer your question. One of the things that's hard is the assumption in, which is easy to make in this environment, is that if I go to discussion, and it's hard without a text, so I'm thinking about your answer. If we go to discussion, we won't actually hit any of the objectives I need to do in the course of my class. And that is a logical concern and fear, because if you're going to go justify this to your boss, this is what I want to try to do, how do you guarantee then the kids are actually going to know something? And I've talked to different people who do different things. I very often, when I'm preparing for class, will write a bunch of different questions. And as the kids, the questions would lead to certain objectives. As the kids either hit the sort of knowledge objective there or ask the question themselves, I cross that out. That's how I keep track of what are they actually knowing and understanding. I talked to another teacher who writes down a list of objectives, and as they're monitoring class, they just cross them off. Okay, so that's it's remarkable at really every age level what the kids are able to cover and understand in a conversation that we're not driving. So I used to teach a class which at Regents is 3 years, and at my old school is 1. They had a text, though, so that's a bit of an advantage. And we never covered anything in depth. And my fear about switching at this other school to discussion was that we'd never actually get to anything. And the reality was what happened is when I added a discussion a week from an outside text, I could do more in 3 days of lecture in one discussion and get the kids into it more than I could in 4 days of lecture. So I don't have sort of a 100% answer for you other than that. I would hope that if you could find an age-appropriate reading that would fit in with your seventh grade kids, that you could strategically place it in a way that when you then lecture, I wouldn't do it as the last thing, I'd probably do it in the middle, so that then when you lecture the next day, you could base a lot of your lecture off the foundation that you guys did in discussion. And the other thing I can add to that is the really good part of the discussion happens within about 20 minutes. So I could, and if I wanted to retool the class, have 20 minutes of discussion and then really about 20 minutes of lecture, because those sometimes those last 20 minutes, even when the seniors are, you know, supposed to be really good, it starts to kind of fade into me asking a lot more questions. So if you look at the ratio from beginning to end of the class of how much I'm talking, I'm not talking a lot, then I talk more, and then I talk more, and then I talk more, because the kids start to reach the end of their knowledge. So maybe it's something you could squeak in for 15 minutes a week and test how, okay, we did this, and the kids see how the kids, what they get out of it, and see if it makes your lecture life a little more easier. Because that's brutal, not having a book. Yikes. Man with the green shirt. Sorry, I'm not going to the far back. I'm working my way. Sixth grade. Okay. Right. 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 Well, sure. The question was at lower grades, what are those tools that I mentioned earlier that I'm looking to see developed? If it's not specifically discussion, what are the tools that lead? I would say the kids that come into the high school are quite good at discerning what facts are. I guess in reading history specifically, what is good fact? What is a good fact to really base things off? What is maybe less important right away? A lot of times, just how to read for understanding of what's going on. Can they explain the big picture? Can they explain the relationship between why this event follows this one? Just starting to get into that is building that. That's what I see as them getting those tools, is just starting to see that. And then their development in 7th and 8th grade through the logic classes and starting to understand how to form argument starts to happen after they start to figure out, well, what is important fact. So that's kind of this development I see at those younger ages. I'll keep going back. How do you give opportunity, or do you give opportunity to kids that know they're going to? Ooh, like, do you get penalized for missing class type of deal? No, you don't get penalized for missing class. If a student misses, the question was, if a student's not in class, what happens? If a student misses class, I expect them to get the notes and catch up. They don't lose out, because I keep attendance also. They don't lose out. They don't appear on my notes as having not spoken, because when I then go into the grade book, I'll check, which is on the computer, I'll check and say, okay, they weren't here, they shouldn't have spoken, so they don't get the C minus or the F. I did have a teacher in high school who was my favorite teacher. It was my Latin teacher my senior year. He would, if you didn't speak, you got a zero. If what you said was wrong, you got a zero. And one day we were all late getting out of chapel to his class, and he had already asked us all questions. We weren't even there. So when we showed up, he said, "Sans, you have a zero." I was like, "Why? We just got out of chapel. I don't care. I asked you, you know, to recite this, and you didn't." So, needless to say, we never skipped his class, but I went to a boarding school, so that's a different issue altogether. So I don't penalize a kid for not being there. However, our school policy is if they are not excused from being there, I could give them a zero. So in other words, if they did skip my class and there was no justifiable reason, I would give them a zero for that day, which would implode their sort of history career and life at Regents. Yes, ma'am. I'm going to use the right side now because I've sort of picked on the left. Yes. Right. We're working on that. So the question was, 30% of my grade, that's a big number. Do I have a rubric? In other words, if I'm going to justify to a parent what their child has in my class for participation, do I have a rubric? One of the things we started developing last year, because there wasn't one really, was a set of discussion standards, and we're working on them now, so they're not by any means finished, a set of discussion standards for 7th through 12th grade. And some of the things we look at are clarity of, you know, are they clear in what they're saying? Were they concise? Were they winsome? Were they abrasive? And part of developing the tools, which you were asking about, what are the skills we want to have developed by 12th grade? And that does give us a little bit more justification to a parent, which is nice. I personally haven't ever really had to justify to a parent a student's participation grade with actual data. Usually I catch the student before it ever gets to kind of the parent level and say, you know, that would be a, I'd say, you need to meet with me during study hall, let's talk. And that would be a conversation about what do you think, where do you think you are in participation? Why do you think, or hopefully we're on the same page, but if we're way off, usually they think they have an A and I think they have a C, we then have a discussion, why are we so off? And in the two of us talking, it allows the kid, the student, I should say, to go home and explain what's going on. Because I find 9 times out of 10, if I'm going to fail a kid on for something, I talk to that kid right away. If I give a kid a failing grade on a term paper, first thing I do is have a half-hour conference with a student, and I write a ton on their paper about the conference. Because student goes home, says to mom and dad, I failed. Parent says, why? I don't know. Teacher didn't tell me. Right? That's just common kid, you know, kiddom. That's what they do. So what I can do then is say to the parent right after that, give a phone call, send an email. You know, I had a talk with your daughter about class and my concerns about discussion. Here are the things I talked about. Here's what we said we're going to try to do better. Here's how you can help. And you get ahead of the issue with the parent. This sort of isn't discussion, but it's dealing with things that come up out of it. Get ahead of the issue with the parent and you say, let's work together on helping your child do better. And it's not a judgment on your kid. It's we're gonna work together on this and make it happen. So, because it is a big part of the grade. And I usually say that. You know, it's a big deal. We need to do better. So let's work on it. But it just to fall, 50% of my grade is writing and 20% is quiz. So that Friday grade is 20% of their class. Participation is that other 30%. And then tests, term papers, and all other major writing in class essays are 50% of their grade. So I do weight in my class, the class to mirror what I see as important, writing and speaking. Of course, the other 20% is really writing also, but that's a secret. In the other classes, they balance that out a little bit differently. In ninth grade, speaking may not be 30% because they're still developing that. So the proportion changes. Anyway, so. In the back, sir. Oh, right. That's a good question. So, yes, I'm still working. The question, how do you develop questions? Do you have a rule of thumb? I'm working on a rule of thumb, and I still ask many questions, and I'm still blessed with students who will turn to me and say, nobody's going to get that question. So I'm still working out the system for developing good questions. What I have found so far that work in getting the kids to discuss our question, not compare and contrast. I personally kind of loathe compare and contrast. I don't know why we do it all the time. I don't like to start out a sentence with compare and contrast. So what I'll do is I'll usually make up kind of a radical statement, make up a quote. And this I sort of stole. It's an AP format that I kind of borrowed. I didn't steal anything. Where I'll make a statement that is biased about some event, and the students will then have to either defend the statement or refute the statement. So it might say, you know, Mr. Saws is a lousy speaker, defend or refute the statement. And so I force the kids to take a stand one way or another about a statement that's based upon the reading. That I found work pretty well. I find when I try to create what I think is going to be sort of a sassy, great question, it's either has 3 or 4 sentences, at which point it's no longer a good question, or it's so obscure or so specific that the kids don't really, they can't answer it. Or they answer it in one sentence, and I think, wow, I got nothing. You know, I thought this was a great question. This kid knocked it out of the park because it had an answer right away. So I found that analyzing a trend through a time period works well. And the big one would be I like is to either analyze a particular statement with respect to another event or to defend or refute the statement. And I found little notes on my board when I come to class the next day, because the kids like to make fun of me, that'll say, Mr. Saz's homework question was ridiculous. Defend or refute this statement. So the kids will sort of harass me because I have these specific things I do that are kind of my character traits apparently now. But they work so far, I've found. And I'm still very much in the learning process of COVID, because I come up with plenty of flop questions that have 5 minutes of discussion, and the kids then say, what now? And so I have to think of another question. It's also why I write 5 or 6 at night, so that when the one I write that flops does, I can pick up with something else as if, oh, I planned it to happen that way. So good question, though. Sir? Yeah, sir, with a goatee. Yes, the obviously unprepared student. I get them also. It happens. Sometimes the unprepared student, there are different scenarios. Sometimes the unprepared student will say, cover their lack of preparedness with stupidity. It's a juvenile response, but it happens. And silly remarks. And I've yet to encounter anything at Regents where I had to pull someone out of class right away. At other schools I have, where if they're just being completely ridiculous, I say, look, you're not cutting it. But usually that's an immediate after class discussion. Say, hey, come here. This is what you get for today. Why do you think that's happened? And they know why. It's very obvious also in the discussion environment that somebody doesn't know what they're talking about. And you can even probe them if they say, well, I think this happened. Why? Well, because isn't an answer. You know, did you do the reading? And that is, you're kind of treading the line there of you feel powerful as a teacher because you're about to nail this kid. I don't push it too far after that. I just say, okay, you know, I know, they know, I know, the class knows, I don't need to take it any farther. It's usually pretty obvious. So, ma'am, sorry, and then I'll get the... I think ideally in the whole world of discussion thing, I'm supposed to say no. It's supposed to just happen. But because I'm not supposed to actually be in control of the situation. But the reality is I do. And a lot of that is dictated by the reading, I pretty much know they only know this segment of the reading, so I know they need to get here. But I also think when I look at tomorrow, all right, I need to be able to start with their understanding of these things. I will generally summarize with 5 or 10 minutes to go. I do what I call boarding it up, and I have a big whiteboard behind me, but the kids know what I mean. All right, I'm going to board it up, and they all kind of go, yes, because it means they're off the hook. And they can take notes, but I basically summarize where we're going. So if they don't actually reach where they need to go, in other words, I know tomorrow I have to start with they need to understand the causes of the War of 1812 by tomorrow, and they're not getting it. I have 5 minutes. I'm going to say, all right, here's what you guys have talked about, and I create a little web on the board, and I get them to kind of figure out with my specific guidance the kind of end product. So yes, I do, when I see it's necessary, I definitely step in and engineer a discussion to make sure for history that they get what they need to get, because tomorrow is going to be based on today, and if they don't get it, I'm starting to let them waste a little time. That's not fair to them. Yes, the tests I give are based upon their readings and class discussion. So, was that your question? Oh, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Do you have students who, let's say at the senior level or perhaps at the level, that are honest enough to come to you ahead of time and say, hey, you know, we have to take grandma to the hospital.
Right.
I'm not
Okay, the question was, how do I handle a situation where a kid comes and says, you know, some family emergency came up, I haven't done my work, can you help me out a little? In all honesty, I'll probably let that go. I am not in a place to judge the authenticity of that statement. I'd rather, if they're lying, which would be shameful, but it's probably happened, I'd rather lose that small battle right there then really hammer a kid and having the mom call me or the dad call me and say, what are you thinking pounding on my kid? We were at a funeral. Yeah. So that's a battle I have decided it's not worth fighting. But it gets registered. And I'll write it down, so-and-so not prepared. Here's the condition. Because 2 weeks from now, if they say, and all of a sudden that's a pattern, and what I can do then is talk to my colleagues and say, hey, what happened on this day? Well, I noticed that too. Oh, it turns out they were at a concert Sunday night, you know, and they're tired. So all of a sudden then the change is the dynamic. But I'm not going to fight a kid over the intent. But I'll give him a break. Yeah, I wouldn't call him out. But they might, you know, in the end, I'll probably forget. And they'll probably I'll say, you know, you're probably going to take a hit for today's discussion. But just keep in mind, it's one day out of 150, and it's not that big a deal. And, you know, and say, if you need to talk to anyone, and you turn it into a I care about you conversation rather than I'm here to destroy you, and I just love it. So, ma'am, sorry. Okay. Right. Sure. Good question. A success story of someone who's gone from sort of technical detail to actually writing well. It is four, by the way, so if you all have places to go, I'm not going to be offended. That's a tough one. Yes, there are kids who have gone from... Often where I see it is they're lazy. They're smart and lazy. So all they do is write the bare minimum. To realizing... I had a junior boy who just graduated as a senior last year. So over a two-year span, I taught him. And I saw him go from really smart, lazy guy, who to me isn't necessarily smart, not acting smart anyway, but a really smart, lazy guy to a great history student with whom I had great one-on-one conversations in study hall. And I didn't necessarily do anything where, like, I sat down with him and said, here's what you got to do. I just never gave him a break for being lazy. And he knew it. I just called him on it. You know, this was supposed to be a 5-page paper. You wrote 3 pages and then you triple spaced 15 point fonted it. It deserves an F. You know, it's an F. And his response was, yeah. You know, and so, and then I said, look, you're smarter than this. Next paper, you're going to meet with me every week for an hour. And so it wasn't, you're being lazy, I'm not going to spend time with you. It was, you're being lazy, so we're going to spend a lot of time together now until you're not lazy anymore. And so that's kind of my approach, is to do it, to kind of partner with the kid. And then if the parent didn't even have, I remember the parent said to me later, last October, my son hated you. Not in a mean way, because she then followed up, but he loves talking to you about history. So he hated me because I made him work, but he loved talking about history. So the end result was, he's a great guy. He's not as lazy in my class. So that's pretty much, I said, stay on him. But, ma'am, sorry, I finally got back. Yes. Ground rules for discussion. At the beginning of the year, I create them because the class doesn't yet have a dynamic. And so the rules will generally be you'll come to class on time, you know, the basics, be prepared. Those are the rules of the class. But then three would generally be you're going to make eye contact with the person to whom you're speaking. You'll address each student by name when you're talking to them. If you're referring to their comment, you'll use their name. I liked Jeff's comment because it tied into what I wanted to say, which is, and so you're developing an environment of camaraderie rather than, well, I want to beat your statement by this statement. And then I also have rules for myself. Mr. Saws will mediate the discussion. Mr. Saws will not let people bully other, you know, not bully, but dominate discussion. Mr. Saws will not interrupt, or, you know, things like that. Mr. Saws will give lots of A's is usually what the kids want me to write, but I don't put that. So, but yes, we have rules for discussion. That's on a piece of paper I call rules for discussion. About 2-3 weeks into class when we have our own dynamic, I have the kids create the rules. And they usually create the first 8 for what the class will be like, and then I let them make the last 2 for what I'll be like. And I tell them, you can't put Mr. Saws will give a lot of A's. It's what you really want me to do when you guys are talking. And there are obviously more, but it gives the kids a little bit of ownership over how the class is going to look. So yeah, we definitely have rules.